Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
This message comes from BOF sponsor eBay. You'll know real when you get it. It'll say eBay Authenticity Guarantee. And you'll feel it. Maybe it's a head-turning handbag, a watch that says it all, jewelry that makes you look like the gem, or sneakers and streetwear so fresh every step feels fly. eBay gets it. So look for the blue checkmark next to that thing you love. And be confident that every inch, stitch, sole, and logo is checked by experts. With eBay Authenticity Guarantee, you can trust that feeling of real is always in reach. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal. Visit ebay.com for terms.
Hello and welcome to the Motor Mouth Podcast with Harry Benjamin and Tim Sylvie. This is the place where we meet some of the biggest names in and around motorsport, chat about their lives and everything in between.
We've partnered with the Brain Tumor Charity, a cause that means a great deal to me personally. Thanks to our partnership, we've been able to create a short series of special podcasts uncovering those within the motorsport community who've been affected by these devastating diagnoses. You can hear my story, as well as the Williams Formula One team's planning director, Richard Jones, now with more to come. Also, bookings are now open for the Motormouth Charity karting event with places for the day now on general sale. Enter your team of four to an endurance race and compete with and against a host of motorsport celebs or pro drivers who will be drawn at random to be on your team. Gates open at 12:30 and close at 6 p.m. For all the information and to see who you could be up against, head to motormouthkartrace.com. We'll see you there, and together we can help every single person affected by a brain tumor. Without you and our sponsors, we wouldn't be able to carry on doing what we do, which is bringing you the biggest names in motorsport and delving into their lives and opinions. This season, we couldn't be happier to be teaming up with Devanti Tires. What drives you? The pursuit of excellence never ends. You can now enjoy the thrill of the chase with Pro Tourer Sport from Devanti Tires, featuring the latest innovations in tire technology, including intelligent water management and precision engineered interlocking tread blocks. Pro Tourer Sport has been designed from the ground up to enhance every aspect of your driving experience. Independently tested at Europe's toughest proving grounds by the most respected names in tire research, Pro Tourer Sport is at one with the driver. Ask your Devanti dealer about Pro Tourer Sport today. Discover Pro Tourer Sport at devanti-tires.com/Pro Tourer Sport.
Hello everyone, Tim Sylvie here. Now today's guest hails originally from Exeter in Devon. And did you know, Harry Benjamin, that Exeter, cue the creepy music, was the last place where women were trialed and executed for witchcraft? Yes, that's right. For more than 100 years, Exeter was England's epicentre for witchcraft. Temperance Lloyd, Susanna Edwards and Mary Trembles were the so-called Biddeford witches. They were hung at Exeter Prison just as a law was passed in the 17th century ending the activity of witch hunting. What do you make of that, my friend?
Wow. What? I really want to know what your search history is like, because with every single show, there's some weird fact you pluck out from somewhere. Well, that's actually, I'm quite fascinated by that. Well, I did a bit of what was it, school that you study? A bit of the Crucible. That's all about witch hunting and all that. Yeah. So I thought it was more of an American thing, but clearly much closer to home.
Yeah, until we banned it, quite rightly. You know, there's no need to hunt and hang witches, not in this day and age. What's new? Well, I tell you something that's new that we can talk about now. And by the time this goes out in a few weeks' time, we can certainly talk about it. You made your commentary debut.
Yes, I have. I'm a commentator now, which is weird.
You're a commentator. tell us just quickly, how was it? This is Porsche Supercup in Monaco. So we're a bit behind the times here because, bearing in mind, this is being recorded.
So, yeah, we might even be Austria by now. Yeah, no, so I joined the F1 guys to do the Porsche Supercup. So first ever commentary, really. So throwing it at the deep end a little bit, at a track where there could be no bloody overtakings. That's always fun. And then there was a 30-minute red flag when the race is 30 minutes long in itself. So,
fantastic.
So that was fun. But you know what? I loved it. It was great. Shouting at fast cars as your job is not like the worst thing in the world. So
I
made a few mistakes already because then you have the team PR people emailing you, being like, actually, he was actually this in 2018, not 2019.
Be quiet.
So I had to sort of apologise and be a bit sheepish on that. But hey, for a first one, I think I just about got away with it. So on to the next.
I think you did really well. Well done, you. Future Crofty, but better. right, should we introduce today's guest?
Oh, I think so. We've made him wait long enough.
So today we're joined by Harry Tingle, who burst onto the scene in 2013 in European F3 before winning in LMP2 at Le Mans. He's gone on to be a serial winner and champion in GT and Le Mans prototype racing. He's raced for the likes of US giants Chip Ganassi, Fortec, legendary British outfit Carlin, Aston Martin, and many more. It's our pleasure to have him here. Harry Tingle, welcome to the Motormouth podcast.
Thanks, guys. I mean, less about me. Those facts about Exeter were insane. I'd never heard of those before.
Oh, come on. You must know that Exeter was...
Odyssey. Stop this in the hometown.
It's famous for it. I started reading up about Exeter and witches, and it goes back a long way. It's literally the epicentre. It's nuts.
Mate, fascinating, but I genuinely have never heard of it. So, every day is a school day, I guess.
Well, next time you're back there, you've got something to talk about around the dinner table. Well, where are you? Where are you at the moment? Where are you joining us from?
I'm in London, Southwest London. Yeah, sort of moved up here 2015 time. I guess as the racing sort of got busier and busier, and you know, just flying off every week, you know, up and down the A303 to Heathrow just got a little bit too much. So it's definitely a lot more convenient, but still try and get back to Exeter as much as I can.
Well, I was going to say, when you're down in Exeter, are you a keen surfer? Are you hitting the waves, if that's even a thing?
I mean, I have done it. Yeah, I have done it, obviously. I would say it's probably more of a boarder.
I was going to say, could you actually stand up?
it's a bit cold for me. I haven't got the highest body fat percentage, so I do get a bit cold even with a wetsuit on, to be honest. But no, I have done it a little bit. I remember we were actually racing in Australia at the start of last year, and afterwards went to Byron Bay for a few days. I was with Ben Barnacker at Jet Manchester. I said, I booked us a surfing lesson. We'll go surfing. It was amazing because, you know, you're just in the board shorts and it's like, oh, this is more like it. And then I had a message from on Instagram from one of my mates from Exeter, who is actually a medic out there. We went for a drink that night and I was like, oh, mate, you know, we used to be surfing in Cornwall or Devon, and now surfing in Byron Bay, this is insane. And then he got a picture out and showed me someone's leg after a shark about half bitten it off like the previous week on that beach. And I was like, right, take me back to
never again.
I'm never surfing in Australia ever again in my life. But we do it, that it a little bit, but not. I wouldn't say I was the next Kelly Slater or anything like that.
You do get the odd great white off the coast of Cornwall. I read about it in the news not that long ago that they had a couple of great whites.
Is this where you get your facts from as well? That same website.
Yeah, it's the same
place. Mate, you must have like Southwest News, like sort of direct to the phone or something. Yeah, mate, amazing.
We're professionals here. You know, we do our research on our guests and their hometowns.
That.
What I do want to know though is I think all of us, after this horrible 12, 18 months, are desperate to go away on holiday somewhere. Devon and Cornwall, rather, lovely place to go. Where's the best place to go in the southwest if you want a bit of sunshine, a nice beach, and just chill out for a while?
Yeah, I mean, you can't really go wrong with Devon and Cornwall, can you? I mean, obviously, like, lucky to be brought up around there. I'm from a little town called Sidmouth, which is on the sort of south coast, and that's really nice. I mean, I don't know if you're into folk music, but they have a folk festival there for like 10 days every August, which is it attracts an interesting clientele, shall we say. But it's all super nice down there. I mean, like Woolacombe, places like that up in North Devon are great, like you say, in sort of surfing, and obviously Cornwall's amazing. You know, places like Padstow, Falmouth, and places like that. I actually used to go down a lot to a little village called St. Moore's, which is just sort of the other side of Falmouth. Believe it or not, actually, Dave Richards owns a hotel and a couple of restaurants down there. I remember when he was in charge of BAR, and I was in karting, I sort of walked around and sort of try and catch his eye a little bit. And then, it was funny that, you know, obviously, how many years later, you know, I was racing for Pro Drive at Le Mans in an Aston Martin. So it's funny how that story, you know, how that sort of all came turned around and just being random in this little village in Cornwall. But yeah, St. Moore's is lovely as well.
Well, fun fact about Dave Richards. So I when I lived in Abu Dhabi, I was working at Yas Marina Circuit, and I randomly moved into a flat with his son, Jamie. Jamie Richards, and we had a lovely place in Abu Dhabi when Jamie was working at the racetrack as well. And then I sort of felt like, you know, I was in with the family then, because, you know, I was like living with his son, you know, he must know who I am. And I saw Dave Richards at the Autosport Awards a couple of years later, went up to him. I was like, oh, Dave, how's it going? And he's friends with my auntie and uncle as well. I was like, you're friends with my auntie and uncle. I used to live with your son. He basically, he might as well have said, just get lost. Like, how dare you approach me? I was like, but I kind of sort of know. And I just walked away with my tail between my legs being blanked by Dave Richards. But there we go.
Yeah.
Listen, let's get back to racing. When did this, when did the motorsport bug hit you? When did you first think, I'm going to get in a kart and see how we get on?
Well, I used to watch F1 with my dad when I was like maybe 3 or 4 years old, which I guess is probably not the most normal like program to be watching as a 3 or 4 year old, but yeah, I was just really into it. Sort of got a, you know, slight memory of watching F1 and always being interested in it. And then when I was 7 years old, we went on holiday to Sardinia, and opposite the hotel was a kart track. And you know, I was a big Mika Hakkinen fan at the time. You had the t-shirt, everything like that, you know, would leave lunch early to go back and watch qualifying on the TV and everything. So yeah, I just started going to the kart track every day, basically, and yeah, absolutely loving it. And came back and started, you know, just doing some research on my own. I think it was like just when Google just started, I guess. And
showing your age,
you know, sort of typing in UK kart and everything like that, sort of working out where the nearest tracks are. And then for my 8th birthday, I got a little 60cc go kart from my parents, and that's where it all started, to be honest. And you know, for the first 2 or 3 years, it was sort of just, you know, like once a month. Dad and I, dad on mechanics, me and the driving, neither of us really knew what we were doing, to be honest, but it was just a bit of a laugh. It wasn't particularly serious. And yeah, just kind of grew from there, really. And it's amazing how fast it can sort of, you know, go from being a little hobby to all of a sudden you're racing all over the world in karting and, you know, trying to make a career out of it.
Well, yeah. When did that moment come where it went from, you know, being a bit of a hobby to, okay, this, I want to make this my career now? Was there a moment where you just sort of had a bit of a realization, or was it progressive?
Yeah. Well, when I was about 10, Dad and I were just doing like once a month. And then we met a guy called Harry Soden, who had a race team at the time in karting, just one or two drivers. And he basically sort of took over running me, basically, and we sort of moved up the ranks with him. And then when I was 11, I won a round of the British Championships, basically under 16 British Championships in junior TKM. And I think it was at that point, it's like, okay, maybe there's more to this than just like a little bit of, you know, bit of fun. And so with Harry, he then, you know, took me into Europe. I was racing sort of Jica and KF2 over Europe with Dino Chiesa's team, who ran Hamilton and Rosberg and everyone like that. So that was, that was obviously a great experience. And then from there, I got the opportunity to go into cars. You know, I did the former BMW scholarship, which went really well. And it's kind of, at this point, I was like 16, and it's kind of like, okay, do I sort of continue a school and try and make the, you know, make them both work, or do I go flat out down the racing route and, you know, see where we are when I'm sort of 21, 22, and if it's not worked out, sort of go back and try and do the education after. So I don't think you can do both properly. And that's kind of, you know, that's kind of how it works. And I stayed with Harry all the way through to sports cars, to be honest. And now he's obviously doing fantastically well with drivers like George Russell and Dan Ticktum, and you know, he's really grown as well. So we kind of learnt the ropes together a little bit in the car world. Obviously, Harry's super influential in karting and knew everyone in karting, and then he sort of came with me to cars. And I think at the time, everyone was kind of like, "Oh, why have you got this guy sort of following you around everywhere?" But I think it was actually really useful. And I think when you look now, you know, the entourages are quite impressive. You know, you've got the physio and the manager and all the rest of them.
Would you classify him as essentially your manager, you know, to a degree? I mean, we've spoken to some guys who have made their way up through the ranks with no management and no support at all, and have really regretted it and found life challenging and have learned things the hard way, really, because they've not had anyone to tell them otherwise. Was he guiding you through the sport at that stage?
Yeah, he was certainly in karting fully, and then in cars. When I went to cars, actually through a mutual friend, a guy called Joe Wheeler, Harry and Joe introduced me to Alan McNish, and Alan kind of took on the role of sort of at the time more sort of like mentoring and working with Harry a little bit on the management side. But I think there was, back in those days, you know, you're in Formula Renault, Formula 3, of course, you want to be with the best team and get the best deal. But in terms of actually like management, there's not loads to it. It's more sort of mentorship and sort of, you know, Harry would, you know, be sort of making sure I'm, you know, in the right frame of mind and, you know, doing all, you know, organizing the training, sports psychology, anything like this. So yeah, I guess it was more sort of management. And then Alan was sort of mentoring in the background, be the one who maybe comes to a few races and be like, you should do this different, or, you know, start doing this, saying this in your reports, or, you know, trying to basically just guide me using his experience. I obviously still racing top line sports cars at the time. And then when I went to sports cars, Harry sort of was then at that point kind of had, you know, five or six other drivers and was bringing them through. And it was kind of a natural point where, you know, Alan knew everyone in sports cars. So kind of that's kind of came to like a natural conclusion. We're still very good friends, still speak to him all the time. And like I say, obviously, he's absolutely smashing it now with Infinity Sports Management that he runs. So so yeah, I mean, it was huge for me, and for sure, having the right people behind you and the right people guiding you is absolutely crucial. So I feel like I was very lucky and done well with Harry and Alan sort of managed me all the way through from literally 10 years old, basically.
What are those main challenges? Because I mean, we talk to obviously a lot of racing drivers, and the biggest challenge, of course, when you're a young racing driver making your way up through the ranks is predominantly probably financials as well, trying to make sure you've got the package in place and you've got the deal for the following year. But if I take that away, what are the recurrent challenges? You know, is it all mentally, or is it also, you know, having to be constantly training? You know, what for you was that big challenge? And do you think, you know, that is still around today for young races coming up, or has it changed in this modern day as well?
Yeah, definitely. Obviously, the financial side is huge. And I think, obviously, as a young driver, the more you can focus on the driving and the training and everything else, the athletic side of it, and at least you have to worry about the business side, the better. So if you have people who can sort of take that pressure off, that's great. In terms of the actual, how they can help, I mean, obviously, you know, when you're young, you know, you're 16, 17, you're away from home for the first time, keeping you on a little bit on the straight and narrow, keeping you in check is definitely helpful. I mean, I think the main thing is opening doors and the contacts and, you know, getting those one test where you go and prove yourself, or the one simulator sort of evaluation. A lot of the time you might have 10 people with similar CVs, and it then comes down to like contacts and, you know, people just being able to open the door slightly for you to be able to drop a shoulder and sort of barge your way through it, kind of thing. So, but of course as well, you know, having someone who's been there, done it, got the t-shirt, won them one outright, won every big, you know, endurance race, being in Formula One like Alan, he can sort of see from a, you know, what I could do better and what I could do worse. And, you know, having worked with a few younger drivers myself a little bit over the last few years, it's easy to spot. But at the time when you're 16, 17, it may not always be obvious to you. So having that little bit of guidance is great and just give you that extra 1% that you might need over the competition.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And there's obviously, you know, outside of the management, there are other things that may help a young driver through their career. And you were invited to join the BRDC Rising Stars program in 2010 and then chosen by the Motorsports Association to take part in its driver development program. How important are those kind of achievements and support networks to the process? Or are they more of just a badge on a shirt? You know, you see there's a lot of rising stars from BRDC. Not all of them make the grade and make their way through. It does it have value, or has it lost a bit of that?
Look, you know, let's get it right. When you're a youngster coming through, the most important way of supporting someone is financially. And of course, you know, it's very difficult to do. It's very expensive, and it's only sort of getting exponentially more expensive. So, you know, the MSA, the BRDC, they can't physically do that with funding. So the next best thing is to help with support. And, I think they were useful. And I think if I didn't have an Alan, it would be even more so. But regardless, I think it was very good. Of course, there's like a status of it, you know, attached to it, and having that logo, having that badge, you know, just felt like it gave you a sort of a little bit of a boost over the opposition. But they had some very, very good attributes to the programs. And you know, with the BRDC, obviously their contact pool is huge, so we had like a load of talks with, you know, industry experts. I remember we had a sort of a Q&A with Patrick Head when he was still very much involved with Williams F1, and it's just that's like money can't buy opportunities. And on the MSA Team UK, there was probably a bit more funding involved with that, and that was brilliant, you know, run by David Brabham and Fiona Miller. And we used to do, you know, we had a load of training up at Porsche Human Performance, which was great, you know, sort of two or three times a year fitness tests, sort of see where we're at. And we would go around to all the different like component manufacturers. So we went to like Avon Tires, we went to Multimatic, we went to Hewland gearboxes and learn about the components of the car. And you don't realize at the time, but you're also meeting, again, very influential people in the industry. And, you know, when I was at Multimatic, I met Larry Holt. And at the time, I just thought, oh, you know, he's a very eccentric guy who loves dampers. But little don't know, in a few years' time, he would be my boss, you know. So that was cool. And we had some really amazing experiences as well. I remember we did this, Brabs organized this 24-hour military toughness test with the Marines, right? And it was in Surrey somewhere, and on the MOD land, and we went down there, and it was kind of like, you know, who's going to drop out first, you know, 24 hours. And it was like, you know, myself, Alexander Sims, James Collado, Will Buller, Jack Harvey, and a few rally drivers as well. There's about 12 of us in total. And anyway, we did this 24 hours, didn't sleep. You know, we were sort of getting beasted, skinning rabbits and doing all those other stuff. And at the end, anyway, everyone survived in terms of didn't drop out. And at the end of it, they sort of asked us for some feedback. And they're like, what would your feedback be? And we were kind of, like I said, we had all this like sort of banter between us beforehand. And we were sort of like, well, to be honest, making it a bit harder would be better, because no one dropped out. Big mistake. Because 6 months later, we went back for a 48-hour military toughness thing, and it was just carnage. So they gave you this kit list to bring, and if you didn't follow it to the absolute letter of the law, you know, it was a 45-minute beasting session. And so, like, I remember the guy was shouting at me, like, 45 minutes into the 48-hour. He was shouting at me, and I couldn't, he was like in my face, and I couldn't see him because I had the blacks in between my eye, because I was just so exhausted. And we did this like 10-hour hiking, and we're doing all this anyway. By the second day, everyone was dropping my flies, and it was by the end, it was just myself and Jack Harvey and Will Buller. And the final thing they did was we basically made this like tripwire across the road. And it's like a mock ambush. So we had a tripwire across the road, and then either side was like a wire, and they attached like party poppers. And he basically said, when you hear the tripwire go, you basically pull either side. We have these like sort of mines that you pull, and creates like this concoction of chaos. And then we had these sort of M16 machine gun BB guns, right? And he said, so then you jump up from behind the bank, and just, you know, you pull the mines, it's all kicking off, and then you just, you know, you just shoot everyone that's still alive. Basically, this is what happened in real life. So we set it all up. So Jack's in the middle, I'm at one end, Will Bowler's at the other end of this wire across the road. And we've got this wire wrapped around our finger. And he said, right, just stay there. And when you hear it go, just pull it. But can't move, otherwise you'll trip this bomb, this fake bomb. And they just left us there for 3 hours. In the rain. And we'd been up at this point for like 40 hours. And I remember being there, and it's just a mental toughness thing. I remember being there, gripping this gun so tiny. I was like, when that tripwire goes off, I'm going to, no mercy, point blank with this BB gun, just absolutely annihilate these people. And, but yeah, and so we did all these amazing experiences and stuff like that. And like, sometimes you have to ask yourself, like,
what am I doing?
Does that make me a quicker racing driver? The honest answer is I'm not sure, but I think I totally get why they put on these different activities within the program. And, you know, that one was a mental toughness thing. Obviously the educational side was to help improve our feedback. The fitness side was to help us be better in the car. But ultimately, of course, it would be great if they could, you know, these schemes could fund you to do extra testing or something like that, but it's not the case. So I think they did a very, very good job with the pool of money that they had. Yeah, so I think it was great. And for me personally as well, being one of the younger guys on that program at the time, being able to see what Alexander Sims does, what James Collado does, you know, all these older guys, 2 or 3 years older, you know, what sort of how quick they can run 5K, how fit they are, how much knowledge they have on setup and stuff like that is huge for a younger driver. And so yeah, it was great.
Yeah, it's funny, isn't it? I sometimes think with that sort of stuff, like there's a bunch of old boys in a boardroom thinking, right, what should we do next? I've got an idea. Let's put her through like an SAS training program. That'll be good for them. That's a good idea. Let's do that. Like with no real thought behind it. Just like this completely random thing, you know, basically killing some 16-year-old boys.
Yeah. It's so true. It's so true. But I think having Brabs running that, and obviously, you know, the David Brabs, you know, obviously, you know, hugely successful himself. Yeah. And, you know, I think, you know, there's method to the madness.
I'm sure there was.
Of course, like, yeah, I still have it now. I sort of wake up and, you know, and think like, what can I do today to be a quicker racing driver? I don't know necessarily whether, you know.
I think you need another 48 hour SAS train. I think it's about time.
Yeah, exactly. But no, I think it was really good. It was really good fun. And like I say, I mean, it helps with the sponsorship proposal and everything like that when you're part of the UK, you know, elite program and everything like that. So it was good.
Yeah, for sure.
Wow, that is that.
I bet you didn't think we were talking about
no. That's we always talk. It's always the, you know, the regular stuff that you hear about from racing drivers. So it's great to hear those little bits that you just never hear about, like the proper like backstage stuff of on the road to being a racing driver. Mental. Yeah.
Learning how to do a good ambush. Yeah,
exactly. You never know when you might need to whack that out when you're going around Spa. back to what it's helping you with, though, in terms of the actual the four week racing. So if we fast forward a little bit to British F3 now with Fortec, you had some great moments in that as well. And I suppose making your way up into the ladder in British F3 must have been quite a boost for you as well. Is there anything that particularly stands out for you at that point in time as you're making your way up there?
Yeah, I had a good year the previous year in British Formula Renault, and then moved up to F3 of Fortec initially, and then Carlin in 2012. And obviously, I think F3 is like the university of motorsport, they call it. So I think that's really where you sort of you make yourself or break yourself, I think, in terms of having a career. And I think, you know, I learned a huge amount during those seasons. I think especially 2012 with Carlin, you know, won 4 or 5 races. My engineer, Stefan de Groot, who is sort of taking Lando all the way through to F1 and stuff like that, really sort of, you know, pinned down and really taught me actually like the physics of driving and why a certain situation is quick. But of course, like racing against, you know, people like Kevin Magnussen and Felipe Massa, you know, who I'd be going on to race against in IMSA later on. Obviously, those two guys went to F1 as well. The level was super high. And I think it was, for sure, very tough time, you know, super hard competition. But I think that really, I really got the most out of myself. And I think there was definitely a huge focus on the actual driving technique. And, you know, you had data and video sort of coming out your ears basically the whole time. And there's a huge, you know, it basically like you could learn as much as you wanted to. It was all available. So that was, very, very, good learning time for myself and my career. And I still think back to those years now in terms of when I'm driving and what I learned and, you know, how I can sort of, you know, keep pushing myself forward, basically.
Yeah, it's a real proving ground, isn't it, British F3?
A quick interruption to the show to remind you to check out our sponsor, Davanti Tyres. Actually, I'm not going to say anything. I'll leave it to six-time Olympic cycling champion and racing driver, Sir Chris Hoy.
Whether in my cycling or motorsport career, I'm always looking for that winning edge, the difference between ordinary and extraordinary. I'm Chris Hoy, and I choose Pro Tourer Sport, the new ultra-high-performance tyre from Davanti.
We talked to quite a lot of young drivers on this podcast, and many of them are just about to make the step up to British F3. In fact, one of our recent guests, Rima Jafali, the Saudi Arabian racing driver, is just about to do that process. You were with Carlin at that point. What was Carlin like as a team back then? Because now, obviously, it's, you know, it's basically won everything outside of Formula One. You know, we see it in the States and in the likes of IndyCar, and you know, they've got trophies filling up their factory like nobody's business. What was it like when you were racing for them? Was it a slightly different operation, much younger in its life cycle?
I think they were obviously very successful many years before I joined them. You know, back to when Sato was racing for them, and I think when I joined, they just sort of moved everything into Farnham, into that one mega facility. I don't know if you've been or seen it, but so I think it was a sort of coming of age of Carlin, going from being very successful, maybe not scrappy around the edges, but like it just kind of all came together, and they had big investment, and it looked like the real deal. So it was that was probably the start of those years, and you know, them being successful in everything that they touch, basically, and but having the knowledge and the data of, you know, Jean-Éric Vergne and Daniel Ricciardo and all that, and working with the same people that work with those guys, and them being able to give you advice to sort of match that level and go beyond was amazing. And they, you know, they just sort of started building their simulator and everything like that. So they really were becoming like the destination, I think, for a young driver, and I think where everyone wanted to end up. So that was you know, cool to be sort of a part of that, and then sort of leading their European F3 charge in 2013 with Daniel Kvyat and Jordan King was like I say, a good time. And pretty successful as well. Won a few races, finished fifth in the championship. And then I think from that point, it was kind of like, I was a little bit crossroads in terms of what to do. Do I keep going down the single-seater route, try and go to that GP2, or do I look at other options? I think F3 kind of, at the end of F3, once you have that education, it gives you opportunities. You know, people go to DTM, they go to Japan, they go to IndyCar, they go to, you know, up the ladder towards Formula One, or sports cars. So, they gave me the perfect education to get a professional career.
Do you think most sport should make more of a thing about Carlin? I mean, I think for the average armchair fan who follows Formula One, they probably have never even heard of Carlin. And you've got the likes of Trevor there, who has brought through some of the world's greatest racing drivers and a lot of people who are on the F1 grid now. Do you think they get the credit they deserve, or do you think they're not bothered? They're just, you know, doing their thing and cracking on?
It's a good question. I mean, yeah, Trevor's just such a lovely bloke and got, you know, so much success behind him. I think he's definitely regarded as the man in British junior motorsport in terms of where to go. And you know, I've seen a few little documentaries on Sky Sports F1 where they've gone down and sort of talked about the drivers that made it to Formula One and stuff like that. So I feel like they definitely get a good amount of recognition. Of course, the thing is that motorsport and any sport doesn't stand still, so you've got to keep repeating it year after year. And I think that's what drives Trevor and the team to go, you know, to the next level and keep performing. And like I said, they've got a fantastic amount of engineering and mechanicking staff down there and talent that just were there when I was there and are still there now. And even like, you know, my number one mechanic in F3 is now number one in the IndyCar team, which so wow. It's there's a progression for the mechanics and the engineers as much as there is the drivers. And again, there was those guys who were washing wheels when I was there who are now data engineers or even engineering cars in British Formula 4. So it's absolute, like I say, powerhouse and not just for the drivers, for everyone involved. And I think Trevor is pretty proud of it, and I hope he is because he should be. And certainly I think they'll go down in history as being the most successful Brit junior team in the UK, even maybe in Europe and the world. So it was cool to be a part of it and win races for them. And you know, I even came back and did a season for them in sports cars when they came into sports cars in 2019 and 2020. So it was again cool to be back and you know, in the surroundings of the team. And the good thing as well with them is that, you know, once you're a Carlin driver, you're always a Carlin driver. So you walk back in and, you know, it's a very, very friendly environment. I think sometimes from the outside, it can seem like quite cutthroat or it's all, they only focus on one driver, but it's really not the case at all. I think that, you know, Trevor, regardless of whether, you know, you're going to be an F1 superstar or realistically, you know, you know you're going to do a bit of racing and then go off and do a business career or something. I think Trevor treats everyone in exactly the same way and has a sort of a bit of love for everyone, really. So it's that's really nice to see as well.
Well, they certainly progressed you and your career into sports cars. So let's dive into that because you've had a very successful career in sports cars and continue to do so. But taking that first step into the sports car world, talk us through that. How did that come about? It was 2014, wasn't it, where you switched to sports cars properly through ELMS?
Yeah, exactly. So like I said, at the end of 2013, you know, won races in European Formula 3, finished fifth in a championship. And it was kind of like, you know, like I say, it was at Crossroads, you know, the sponsorship at the time to go to GP2 was probably like 1.2 million. Very, very difficult to find. You know, it's an extortionate amount. And we'd been just, you know, in the background slightly, you know, obviously with Alan being, you know, a legend of sports cars and with Harry as well, we were sort of talking to a few sports cars teams and like, was speaking quite a lot with Sam Hignett at Jota, and they'd run Ollie Turvey alongside their driver Simon Dolan in 2013, and Ollie was moving on to go to the World Endurance Championship, and they needed a driver, so they organised a test for me at Aragon Motorland, and it went really, really well. Really enjoyed the car. The car at the time, the Gibson LMP2 car, is very similar to Formula 3 in terms of power to weight ratio. You know, it had a bit more power and a bit more weight, but actually the driving style is very similar to F3. And got on well with Simon. It's, you know, first time sort of like sharing a car and working together with a teammate as much. I mean, in Carlin, you know, had some good teams, like I say, like Danny Kvyat, but we used to work together quite a bit, but ultimately it's all about trying to beat each other. And but I really enjoyed that side of like sort of working with Simon. And one thing I realized quite quickly with Jota is that, again, they had an incredible amount of engineering prowess, and they knew the car inside out. But kind of all the focus really was on making the car quicker. And I'd just come from an environment where, yes, of course, the car needs to be quick, but there was a huge focus on making the driver quicker. And I was looking at Simon, who was incredible, as a silver driver at the time. You know, he's a very successful businessman who's sort of taken that race up 4 or 5 years ago. And was, you know, a second off, sometimes less, sometimes slightly more. I think that, well, if I can improve Simon 4 tenths, that's better than anything that we can do on the race car. You know, we improve the race car by 2 tenths. That's insane. So I tried to sort of bring in a little bit of the Carlin philosophy to Jota and sort of focus a bit more on the driver and having onboard cameras and going through, you know, if we were lucky at the start, we got one sort of data sheet per morning, whereas I was like, let's look at the data every session and see what we can do to improve. And I think they liked that. And anyway, we got on well with Simon. We managed to deal with them for 2014. And it didn't get off to the best of starts. We were doing really well at Silverstone. You know, I qualified on pole, sort of made a bit of an impact there. And then Simon got very unlucky in the race, got forced off, had this massive shunt. And at the start of the year, we actually, the team had done a deal with this film crew, and they were going to film this documentary called Journey to Le Mans. And it was going to be on Netflix. And I was kind of, at the time, it was, you know, 2014, I was like, what's Netflix?
Yeah.
Where, you know, it was only just sort of coming out. So it's a shame it's still not on there now, because I think, like, it would be so much easier to sort of tell people about it. You can still find it on, like, Apple and, I think, and YouTube and stuff. But I remember saying to Charlotte Fantelli, director, what happens if you have a really boring season? and she said, well, we'll just have to try and create some drama and it'll be fine, but I'm sure you guys will be good. So we started off with a pole and then a massive shunt at Silverstone, like, broke the car off. Luckily, Simon was all good. I think then we came back, had a second at Spine, and we won at Imola before Le Mans. So that was, you know, a big comeback. It was a good part of the story. And then we went to Le Mans for the first time, and that was an, you know, an eye-opening experience, to say the least. I mean, you know, it's 250,000 people there. I think 240,000 of them are on a stag do or a hen do or something. You know, it's chaos. It's like Glastonbury Festival for motorsport. And I remember thinking at the time, you know, this is pretty cool. I mean, this is what I want to be a part of. Again, like, I remember on the scrutineering, so it's the Monday before the race. So, you know, sort of walked into the town and had a big scrutineering in the town centre, and there's thousands and thousands of people there. I remember getting out of the car and literally just getting swamped, like, 10 deep with fans that wanted autographs and something like that. And I was thinking, this isn't normal. This is different. this is different to what I'm used to. And, you know, you really feel like the you know, it's a real special race and the history. And we went there, and we actually had a really disastrous week in the testing and qualifying. We just had no pace. We had issues with the car. This thing had been bulletproof the whole season, and all of a sudden, like, couldn't string three laps together without something breaking. And I think, bloody hell, this is so frustrating. And then for right at the end of the qualifying, we finally got it all together, and I put us P2. And yeah, the rest is history, really. We went out in the race, and while we sort of had a bit of a setback at one point, we came back through the field and we took the lead with like 2 hours to go. And I think by that point, you know, everyone was sort of powerless to stop us. And we went on to win, which was just incredible. I mean, walking out on the podium was, you know, they let everyone from the grandstands onto the pit straight and into the podium, and it's like into the pit lane, sorry. And you're standing there like 100,000 people, you feel like a rock star. You know, it's just incredible. Absolutely amazing.
Amazing. And you did it twice. You won it twice.
Well, yeah, I mean, in 2014, that was kind of probably the make or break moment, to be honest. And having sort of gone there and like four races into sports cars, won Le Mans in P2, that really sort of set me up for what was to come, really. And, you know, I finished the season with Jota and had an offer with Nissan to do the LMP1 program, which I didn't know much. You know, we didn't know much about at the time.
This blows my mind. This one, because this is really familiar to me, because and this is where I first really became aware of you, because at the time I was managing Max Chilton, and he phoned up. He was like, "Listen, mega opportunity. We've been contacted by Nissan. It's an LMP1 seat, the GTR LM Nismo." We saw the photographs of the car. We're like, "Oh, what a beast! This is it! Like this is the moment." And tell us what happened next.
Oh, mate! So, do you know what? That whole experience was actually very, very good for me, even though obviously the on-track performance was diabolical. But
it was awful.
Yeah. So I finished the season with Jason. We were using Nissan engines. So obviously, Alan was straight on to trying to get me, you know, a seat in LMP1 for the previous year, the next year. And, you know, Tom Christian was retiring. Everyone was telling me, "Oh, you know, they've already got your name written into the Audi seat and everything like that." But in reality, obviously, it's, you know, that's not how it works. But anyway, Nissan were very interested. And so I signed a 2-year deal, like, you know, first time sort of being a fully professional driver. And it was amazing. And went to the first test over in America. I was all excited, and I didn't drive the car for the first six testing. It was just so painful. I think partly it was because I wasn't trusted. You know, they had Mark Chenet, Ollie Pla, Michael Krum, much more experienced than older guys. It was partly that, and partly because the team just kept breaking all the time. And it quickly came apparent we were miles behind where we needed to be. We sort of missed the first two races and went straight to Le Mans. But it was still, you know, when the car did run, you know, I was kind of like, let's make the most of it, see where we are. I was kind of naively thought, yeah, we'll get this sorted, and kind of believe sort of the numbers and what the calculations are saying we're going to be the lap time for Le Mans, because I think they're expecting sort of a 3:15, which put us like 3 or 4 seconds off. But in reality, I don't think we got below a 3:30 or a 3:28. So we were sort of 16 seconds off the pace. And it's amazing how your horizons change, because like at Le Mans the previous year, you know, I was like, you know, we're one of the best NMP2 teams, we can go and win. And literally the goal for 2015 was just to qualify for the race, get within 107%. And, you know, it doesn't matter, like, you know, if you're in the back of the grid F1 car or you're in the Mercedes, you're still pushing it to the limit. And I remember, like, just in qualifying, having to be gung-ho just to even qualify for the race. But we did finish, believe it or not, we did finish despite lots of issues, obviously. And, you know, after that, most of the drivers kind of left the program or went and did other things. And we had an extensive testing program for the rest of 2015. And we actually made the car a lot better and a lot more reliable. And I think the car never ran as it was intended with the hybrid system. We were just running the front engine, front wheel drive. I mean, at Le Mans, you would pass a GT car into Arnage, like the slowest corner of the track. They would pass you on the exit, pull in before you had enough traction to then re-overtake. Yeah. It was just, you know, the car was kind of completely hamstrung from where it should have been. But, you know, I went from, like I say, the first 6 days, not driving the car at all, to doing all the testing for the rest of the year and being heavily involved in that development and fully trusted with it all. So, and I've gone from working with maybe 6 or 7 people at Jota to working with 60 or 70 people at the Nissan. So for me as a driver, it was hugely, not only like educational and taking me to that next level as a works driver, but I think it also changes the perception of you from this up and coming, you know, young gun, maybe slightly erratic, maybe, you know, not fully trusted to being a full factory driver. So that was it was an interesting time. And then literally like 4 days before Christmas, they pulled the plug on the whole program. So, but who knows what will happen? I think 2017 was it, or 2016, when Jota nearly won in an NMP2 car.
Yeah.
You know, so if they got the hybrid working, even if it was like 3 or 4 seconds off the pace, if it had been reliable, could have won Le Mans. A lot of people forget that.
It's a real shame, because there were such high hopes for that program, and you know it was such.
What happened to the car?
Oh, God knows where it is now.
I think one of them is in the Le Mans Museum. I'm not quite sure why, but one of them is. I remember seeing a very sad photo, I think, of most of the rest of the parts and spares all getting crushed. Which is amazing, because like this, you know, you have this thing that, you know, is just like treated better than you know, anything in the world. And then all of a sudden it's just straight in the crusher. I do remember seeing that photo a few years later. But it was, luckily for me, you know, I was also still racing with Jota in the European Le Mans Series, you know, with Simon and Philippe Albuquerque. So I still had competitive racing. It wasn't like all my eggs were just in that one basket, but it was a tough time, but on the track. But actually, I think, like I say, it really helped my career in terms of taking me from a up and coming driver to a factory driver. And I think it had, you know, without the Nissan, I'm not 100% sure whether the next programs the factory programs would necessarily have followed. So it was good.
And you can't say no to an opportunity like that, can you, regardless if it takes off or not?
No, and kind of Alan was like, well, I've heard a rumour that it's front engine, but let's hope it's not. Let's hope it's conventional. then we saw those spy shots from Kota, I think it was, thinking, what the hell is that? There's so many stories from there, So it was fun.
There'll be a whole documentary on that probably one day. Yeah. Maybe that's when you needed Netflix. Probably that they could have made that a proper drama filled program.
But 100%. But as much as like Darren Cox was sort of, you know, go in for this crazy risk-taking strategy. You know, he also took risks on the drivers as well. So I am still very thankful for that opportunity. You know, so it was, yeah, it was cool.
Well, it really did. That wasn't the end, thankfully, because you carried on doing sports cars. And as we mentioned earlier, you did win Le Mans again with Aston Martin, obviously, most recently in 2020, further down in the GT category. But I think in the interest of time, we might just fast forward ever so slightly, because you also made the move then to America and IMSA. Sure. So what's it like driving over there compared to Europe, and then how did that move? Obviously still sports car racing, but how did that switch come?
So America's great, absolutely love it. It's sort of it's really fun over there. Tracks are absolutely mental, pretty old school, you know, not much runoff, but really, really cool. Not most of them haven't changed a lot from back in the 60s and 70s, and the racing's really fun as well. I quite like how it's more of an entertainment category, shall we say, in terms of like the yellow flags and stuff. And if they get a chance to throw a yellow 10 minutes before the end, they'll bunch everyone up and go for a grandstand finish. Whereas I think in the WEC and in ELMS, it's a little bit more pure, especially at Le Mans. You know, you're saying about that Aston thing, you know, we knew it was a 3-horse race from maybe 4 hours into the race at Le Mans, because the way it works with the safety cars and stuff, we were a certain amount ahead. And realistically, you're just not, in GT Pro, you're not going to get 2 minutes back on a car on pace. It's just not going to happen. So unless we have an issue, it was kind of down to 2 or 3 horse race at that point. In America, you can never be, until you cross the line, you can never be sure that an easy race victory is won. We had the same thing very recently. Mid Ohio, we're leading by 20 seconds and a yellow came at the wrong time. We didn't even come out the pits in the lead. So it's good fun, and you know, you get to race in amazing races like the Daytona 24 hours, Sebring 12 hours, you know, huge history. And it basically came about because I was racing with Ford Chip Ganassi Racing. Multimatic were running that program, so kind of at the end of the Nissan time, Alan was talking to Ford. We kind of agreed that we were going to stay with Nissan, try and show some loyalty there, and then they pulled the plug. Alan sort of went back and they said, oh, we've got potentially a 3-race deal. I went out to Daytona halfway through the race, sat down with Multimatic and Ford. They put like a little wooden stool in the middle of the motorhome, and I kind of came in and said, I assume this is my seat then. And and they sort of grilled me for 20 minutes or so. Anyway, I did the deal just to be like the third driver for the first 3 races in Le Mans. And that turned into a full-time deal, which turned into a 4-year deal with Multimatic. And then Multimatic were running the Mazda program over in the States. They build the car, do the dampers, everything like that. And they needed a driver for 2018 onwards. So that's how I got into there. And then that kind of filled in nicely as the Ford program ended at the end of 2019 to go full-time in America. Obviously, I got that really nice third driver role with Aston, which turned into another Le Mans win, which was incredible. But my main focus really ever since Ford program ended was on America. And it's a wild ride out there. It's fun. You know, we managed to win the Sebring 12 hours, finished third in Daytona, second again at Sebring this year. So and won plenty of the other races as well. And a big thing for us was, you know, Mazda hadn't won a race for 7 years. So to get that first win for them at Watkins Glen in 6 hours was incredible. There's, you know, it's a huge following in sports cars. You know, it's a real cult following out there. And
yeah, absolutely,
it's really, really good fun.
You know, you've got very well-rounded motorsport experience. You're a student of the sport. You've learned all about it. You've done these activities, like you mentioned, with the, you know, the beasting, and you've put the hard yards in. You talk articulately. You're very fit. You've got this well-rounded view. You strike me as the kind of guy who would make a very good team manager or team owner. Is that on your radar? What's the long-term goal for you? Would you ever run your own team?
I mean, never say never. I think sports cars is coming into a very, very interesting period with the LMDH cars and the hypercars coming, I think, in the America in 23, and obviously they're starting to come into the WEC now. And I think it's going to, you know, there's a massive manufacturer interest. You know, Porsche and Audi have just announced their programs, and, you know, Acura and Toyota, obviously there, Ferrari. It's going to be incredible. I'm sure there'll be many others as well. So I think that's, you know, I think everyone is very excited about that. So I wouldn't say I've looked at anything other than you know, driving a car for certainly for the foreseeable future. I'm just trying to do everything I can to maximize the opportunity I have in America with Multimatic. And hopefully that will lead on to something very exciting for the future, because I think for the next 6-7 years, sports cars is going to be absolutely prime. And, you know, sort of the Peugeot announcement with the, yeah, you know, very cool, the level of drivers that they're bringing in. It's, it, you know, I want to be part of that for sure. And I think the more I can be at the front winning races, that's going to stand me in good stead. So, I mean, you know, I'm not, you know, I look at what Alan's done in terms of going straight out the cockpit, managing drivers, going straight into team manager role, being just as busy as he was when he was driving. Yeah. You've got to admire that incredible work ethic. Whether I'd want to maybe after I finish racing go and do something else, I don't know. I'm honestly not sure. You know, when I was working with Jack Manchester and the Carlin stuff, I was sort of mentoring him a little bit, and I quite enjoyed all that sort of side of it. So we'll see. But I think I've still got plenty of years to give it behind the wheel first before I think about other stuff.
Well, we've got a few, we'll shortly come on to our final three, but a couple of quick fire questions for you. Who's the best racing driver you've ever shared the track with?
Oof. Good question. Carlos Sainz Jr. It's pretty rapid.
Yeah, nice.
I think George.
I think he's done all right, hasn't he?
Yeah. No, I like Kai. We were teammates in 2012. He's very, very fast. I mean, Jack Harvey as well was very good. For me, I think George Russell was potentially one of the next superstar alongside Max in the F1. I haven't raced personally with George, but I know him well, and he's managed by Harriet.
Yeah,
for me, he's
classy driver. One word answer: is sim racing a sport?
Yes. Well, yeah, people are earning money out of it.
Big money. You've had a bit of electric experience in your time. Formula E or Formula One?
I think Formula E is more exciting potentially in the racing wise, but I think now Formula One is more competitive at the front. I think we're in for a good season.
Should we do our final three?
Let's do our final three. Go on, you kick off.
Got it. So we asked this to all of our guests, Harry, just to get a little bit of variety in the answers and see what crops up. So the first one for you, what's got you excited at the moment?
The upcoming regulations in sports cars 23 and all the manufacturers and opportunities that are going to arrive.
Lovely. If not doing what you're doing, being a very successful and fast racing driver, what would you be doing?
I think after my 48-hour military toughness thing, I'm probably not the Marines. I've always been quite good with numbers and quite sort of interested in the stock market and stuff like that. So maybe something in the city, something around that, I would say.
Nice. Okay. And finally, what are you scared of?
multiple insects and reptiles and things like that. But probably right now, going bald.
Oh, no, really? Is it going that way? I mean, you look like you've got a lovely full head of hair there.
Mate, it's selecting reverse. Bit faster, but I like it. You know, I raced in the ELMS this year with Racing Team Turkey, and I've already said to Sally if we could, as part of the deal, if we could put me into a salon down there. I've heard, you know, that's the place to go. So
just shave it
off. When you put some feelers out.
Yeah. I think shave it off. When I get to that point, I am just literally just going to shave the whole lot off. I can't be dealing with it. Harry's never going to get to that point because he's got
a massive head. But people were like, oh, well, Jason Statham looks good with a bald head. Yeah. I was like, yes, it's Jason Statham. Yeah. But, you know.
I shaved my head last year at the height of lockdown because I just couldn't deal with how much hair I had, not to rub it in or anything. But it was just getting so thick. And the barbers had been shut for, I don't know, 6 months at this stage, it felt like. And I just literally went like that. And I would never do it again. I think some faces suit baldness.
Yeah.
Others do not.
Well, I can grow a quite decent beard. So
you could do the opposite.
You don't want to be an upside down head. No, you don't want to be an upside down head.
It's a bad leg.
And the thing is, as well, like, it's interesting because, like, you know, we all had our lockdown experiences, and I went the other way. I went to try and like grow it out, try and grow a man bun, you know. It's like, you can't really run around with that in the paddock unless you're Lewis Howard's so far. This is the only opportunity to get to see what it looks like. But a few of my mates did the same thing, went the other way and shaved it. Now I kind of regret it, because at least I could have seen what it looked like rather than just let it fall out and go, oh no, too late now.
Yeah, you could have had ownership over it then.
Yes, exactly. Well, or just the peace of mind that it might grow back, whereas if you leave it too late, it might not grow back. You know, you only have two or three haircuts left.
Well, you can't have a man bun. Those are the people you walk past in the street and you go, oh, it's awesome.
No, that's what I mean. So the lockdown was the perfect opportunity to see how it went. But yeah, it was not unfortunately, this hairline is it's not suiting that.
Well, what a way to finish. Harry Tingle, thanks so much for joining us. All the best for the rest of this year and the years to come. And I'm sure we'll see you in a paddock soon. Harry Tingle, thanks for joining us on the Motormouth podcast.
Awesome. Thank you, guys.
Before you go, one final reminder to check out our sponsor, Davanti Tyres. What drives you? The pursuit of excellence never ends. Enjoy the thrill of the chase with Pro Tourer Sport from Davanti Tyres. Pro Tourer Sport is at one with the driver. Ask your Davanti dealer about Pro Tourer Sport today. Discover Pro Tourer Sport at davanti-tyres.com/Pro Tourer Sport. Thank you so much for listening to the Motormouth podcast. Do make sure you give us a follow on our socials, Twitter at Motormouth_, Instagram at Motormouth_official, and Facebook, just search Motormouth. You can also download the Motormouth app, where you can get exclusive video content from MMTV, create your own social profile to interact with other fans, and check up on all the latest happenings with whatever motorsport takes your fancy. We're also proud to be supporting the Brain Tumor Charity too, so make sure you check the links in the podcast description to find out how you can help cure brain tumors quicker. Don't forget to like, subscribe, and review. And until next time, you've been listening to the Motormouth podcast.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
This message comes from BOF sponsor eBay. You'll know real when you get it. It'll say eBay Authenticity Guarantee. And you'll feel it. Maybe it's a head-turning handbag, a watch that says it all, jewelry that makes you look like the gem, or sneakers and streetwear so fresh every step feels fly. eBay gets it. So look for the blue check mark next to that thing you love and be confident that every inch, stitch, sole, and logo is checked by experts. With eBay Authenticity Guarantee, you can trust that feeling of real is always in reach. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal. Visit eBay.com for terms.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.